Hello, listeners. This is Dr. Sammy Anand, current secretary-elect of the medical care section and one of the podcast contributors, with a quick recap of the blog articles we had available for you to read in January. Brett Lissenden, Molly Fromer, and Michael Segelman, our friends at RTI International, shared their views on the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Innovations, or CMMI's, health policy evaluations that address parallel or non-parallel trends. These methods help researchers understand the econometric ways in whether causal relationships or conclusions can be drawn from natural experiments. To all those statistics lovers out there, this is a surefire read. Next, we have Sophie Herowitz, David Ming, and Neil DeJong enlighten us in how to engage communities with systems of care for children with complex medical needs. The Children's Complex Care Coalition in North Carolina, or PATH for CNC, just had a virtual convening series, and these authors did their due diligence in determining the challenges and strengths in these systems with an in-depth analysis on how to improve them. If you missed the virtual series or are just more interested in this equitable care and children's health topic, head to the blog to read it now. Their two articles highlight how to start in addressing these challenges and improving the care for these children. Finally, we have Greg Stevens, our medical care co-editor, with an article on what, if anything, might be going wrong with the patient-centered medical home, or PCMH. The growth of telemedicine, access to quick cares such as minute clinics, and a growing shortage of primary care physicians make us ask the question, is traditional primary care here to stay, or are we looking at an evolving model? Is there still value to the PCMH? Navigate to the blog to read more and include your thoughts. Now, let's head over to Dr. Jess Williams, Medical Care Section's former chair and co-editor of the journal and blog, who is interviewing a student award winner and journal contributor for this month's podcast.
Thanks so much for that summary, Sammy. We had some great posts last month. Today, I'll be speaking with Yan Chen Li about her recently published paper, Association of Social Determinants of Health with Adherence to Second-Generation Antipsychotics for People with Bipolar Disorders in a Medicaid Population. She was one of the winners of the 2020 American Public Health Association Medical Care Section Student Paper Awards. Congratulations, Yan Chen, and welcome to the Medical Care Blog Podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So my first question is, how did you become interested in the topic of medication adherence for people with bipolar disorders?
That's a great question. So first, I would like to express my appreciation to you, Jesse, and Medical Care Journal to giving me such a great opportunity to talk about one of my research topics on medication adherence for people with bipolar disorders. And so during my first 2 years in the graduate program at the UMass Chan Medical School, I participate in the research project under the leadership of the Dr. Arlene Ash and Dr. Matthew Alkuski. And the project involved the healthcare payment systems and quality measures and risk adjusting quality measures. And for the value-based healthcare payment system, the concept is to reimburse providers for quality of care they provided. And this has drawn to my attention that to care for patients with bipolar disorders and monitoring their medication adherence has a huge potential become quality measures. But the research in this area was very much needed. And this is how I began like interest in this topic.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. So why is measuring adherence to second generation antipsychotics for patients with bipolar disorders important?
Mm-hmm. So while I was working on some of the health-related research projects, it caught my eyes that the percent of people experience mental illness have been increasingly to 21% of US adult population in 2020. And the bipolar disorder is a chronic mental illness encompassing like manic, hypomanic, and depressive mood episode, and carry a high risk of suicide. and impairment in the academic and work performance, and their social and family relationship also, and also the quality of life. And the study showed that about 7 million people and 2.8% of US adults have bipolar disorder. And the prevalence is even higher at the 4.2% among adults enrolled in the Medicaid programs. So bipolar has been associated with the 9.2 years reduction in expecting the lifespan, and also annual economic burden. It's over $195 billion, is approximately 25% of which is from direct medical costs. So there are the several classes of the medication for treating bipolar, including second generation antipsychotics and lithium, anticonvulsant mood stabilizer, and first generation antipsychotics, and also the antidepressants. And since like 2000, the second generation antipsychotics are increasingly commonly prescribed and considered to be effective for acute or short-term management of mania. So second generation can also be appropriate for the maintenance treatments, particularly for patients with persistent psychosis, or where the treatment goal is to prevent the recurrence of manic symptoms. However, the non-adherence rate can be as high as 60% among patients with bipolar. So it's important to understand what factors are affecting second generation antipsychotic non-adherence for people with bipolar, and hoping to help them to achieve better treatment outcomes.
Makes sense. Thank you. Yeah, that's a pretty high burden of sort of financial costs, but also sort of morbidity costs. It's, mm-hmm. It seems like it's a very important area. And that was a really good explanation, especially for someone like me, who isn't really a medical person, but just more of a researcher, why we actually care about the second generation antipsychotics. So thank you. One of the things I found really interesting about your paper was you had a really thoughtful set of definitions around adherence. So I was wondering, could you explain a little bit about the different measures of adherence you used and why they were appropriate for these cases?
Mm-hmm. So medication adherence is how well a patient is following the instruction with a prescribed recommendation from doctors. And ideally, you know, perhaps in many years from now, a drug tablet contains a chip that can tell us the prescription is taken by patient as recommended. But before the times come, we can only rely on other mechanisms to measure the adherence. And one of the methods is to investigate the patient's fill-refill prescription pattern through the treatment period. And in this regard, the medication adherence is formulated as a ratio. And the numerator of the ratio is the number of the day a patient has the prescription filled or refilled, as evidenced by the pharmacy claim data. And for the denominator of the ratio has several definitions. First, like you either can look at the entire 365 day in a year, or the study period. Or the other method is from initial prescription day until the last prescription day in the study period. And the last method is like you can look at the initial prescription until the day before too long a gap without any refill.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so for my paper, we articulate the medication adherence using all three definitions. So readers can decide which one is suitable for their purpose. And the feature, we also feature define the group non-adherence as a person or patient in a group for who medication adherence is less than 0.8. So for our study population, the non-adherence percentage will be like a 72%, 47%, and 14% by different definitions. So you can see that the percentage of the non-adherence can be very different by the definition. And this is one of the reasons that reporting non-adherence very widely, and the reader must be aware of it.
That's really good advice. Yeah, I really appreciate how thoughtful you were about talking about the differences between the definitions in the paper and sort of why that might be appropriate. I think it's a great model for other people to use. Your analysis included a lot of potential predictors of non-adherence. Which ones were the most important?
We found some interesting results from this research. And the first, we found that middle-aged men and younger women had the higher odds of the non-adherence. And this difference in the age group between men and women may be due to the cause and clinical features of bipolar that is different by sex. And it may also reflect the fact that age between 18 to 35 at the peak childbearing year for women, so which can also affect medication prescription and adherence. And it may be that the second generation antipsychotics show the adverse effect during the pregnancy and lactation, including the gestational diabetes, cesarean section, and preterm birth. We also found that patients with other medical or psychiatric comorbidity or the evidence for more complex illness, and those with the lower social economic status have the higher chance to be non-adherent. As for the question regarding which of them are more important, I would say that all like risk factor we identify in the model work together for predicting medication non-adherence in the best way. I would also say that it very much depends on where you are standing. For example, for woman health specialist, they may find that the woman at childbearing age having a higher chance of non-adherence is informative and want to look for the reason and do something about it. On the other hand, for social workers or healthcare policy makers would feel the same and look for the way to improve adherence for people at the lower social economic status.
That's really great. Thank you for giving us that summary. Yeah, I think it was really nice in your paper how you also included factors sort of beyond the individual. You know, things that can maybe be addressed in sort of more from like a social policy perspective. That's really great. So what types of research questions are you working on now?
That's a great question. I just got recent grad. And so after a graduate, I landed a research position at one of the largest national Center for Dialysis. So,
great. Congrats.
Thanks. So, in just a very short time, I am already involved in the research for risk model on the technique failure for peritoneal dialysis patients, and which can potentially be developed into the risk adjustment model. Mm. Another exciting piece of research topic that I am focused on also is how the COVID-19 affect the patient with the end-stage renal disease. Yeah, so I'm very helpful that I'm really grateful that I can continue to use what I have learned from my my PhD program and training.
Yeah, that's great. Sounds like you have some interesting projects going on.
Yeah.
My last question for you is, do you have any advice for other students who are working on academic papers? And if so, what is it?
I found the most important step to it's finding the interesting topic that you want to focus on, and also determine the gap that need to be filled from the literature. So during my work for PhD research, including writing the manuscript and thesis, I did go through a period of a hard time and stress and frustration.
I think everyone has.
Yeah, I believe that. And so I realized that my mentors simply want to push me to get the most out of me. And so my experience provide a good example for graduate students that you should not be discouraged with difficult topic or hard time, and try, you know, more positive and diligently work with your mentor and the resource that you have. And I believe they will give you the direction, guidance, or any like support you need, you know, achieve your goal. And I also like to share my own great experience.
Sure.
So I, you know, during the program, there's a seven of us in the class, and each of us have their own specialty. And we, as a classmate, we formed the study group together, especially we spend a lot of time at the beginning, prepare for qualified exam, also at the end of the stage, writing the thesis and getting all the publication out. We took the turn to present our work in progress and also try to help review and provide a comment to each other. And it's a great example for my classmates. Grace Master, she has become the co-author in this paper by providing her specialty from the clinical perspective. So I would say leading on peers and feeling the same empathy and helping each other with the project by calling upon our individual strengths are very important part of success for, you know, graduate study and life.
That's fantastic advice. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. We hope to see more of your work in medical care in the future. Thanks again very much. We appreciate having you today.
Yeah, thank you.
And now, here's a quick preview of some of the articles in this month's issue of Medical Care. There are two papers that focus on healthcare at the state level this month. The first covers disparities in access, use, and barriers to care in Arizona by Michael Galloway and colleagues. The other evaluates the impact of Medicaid eligibility changes on long-acting reversible contraception, otherwise known as LARC, in Massachusetts and Maine. A really interesting paper in this month's issue by Victoria Gore and colleagues analyzes COVID-19 and hospital readmissions. They use data from a large New York City safety net system from March to June 2020. And they try to see whether any measures of social determinants of health were associated with readmission following being hospitalized with COVID-19. They found that the readmission rate was 7.3% overall, with a median of 7 days between discharge and readmission. Older age, history of homelessness, coronary artery disease, and other conditions such as congestive heart failure, cancer, and chronic kidney disease were associated with increased odds of readmission. Ideally, their research could be used to help reduce readmissions by adjusting the delivery of care. It will be interesting to see whether the same patterns hold true with more recent data, given the changes in the virus variants, vaccinations, and treatments for COVID-19 patients. I hope they have another study planned. In another paper about readmissions, Amy Rosen and colleagues compare readmissions rates between veterans who receive total knee arthroplasty in the Veterans Health Administration to those receiving the same operation in community care. The paper is based on a 3-year cohort study that ran from 2016 to 2019 using data from both Medicare and the VA. The authors ran a mixed effects logistic regression model that controlled for a host of demographic and clinical factors. Nationally, they found that the odds of experiencing an all-cause or TKA-related readmission was 35% of those in community care. So the VA seemed to be providing surgeries that required fewer readmissions, relatively speaking. However, there were, of course, a few facilities that did not outperform their community counterparts. Other articles this month cover the 2018 merit-based incentive payment system, a scoping review of interventions to reduce ER use among people with alcohol and substance abuse disorder, and some analyses of the Medicare Part D coverage gap, as well as a really interesting applied methods piece on cancer registries. Please head over to the Medical Care Journal website to read some of these fascinating articles. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to chatting again next month. If you have ideas for future episodes, please email editors@themedicalcareblog.com.